हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्रीहद्वैतगदाधर शिव सरिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 20. Okay. Balaram smiled. Krishna is not interested in playing with me, Seshanag. Rather, he gets enjoyment from playing with a common material snake. Another reason he's smiling, right? Remembering Krishna's pastimes as an ordinary mortal, Balaram smiled. He did not speak a word, as this covering of knowledge did not seem proper, and the situation was beyond tolerance. However, when he gave a mere smile, they lost their lamentation, and they thought that nothing unfortunate could possibly happen. Right? So then here's another thing. By him taking that mood, then he removes their lamentation. Becoming joyful, after his smile, they gave up their desire to give up their lives. Right, so he's not going to bring in the knowledge to remove it because it's not appropriate. But at the same time, just by his smile, then he removed the problem. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued. The residents hurried toward the bank of the Jamuna in search of their dearmost Krishna, following the path marked by his footprints, which bore the unique signs of the personality of Godhead. The footprints of Lord Krishna, the master of the entire cowherd community, were marked with the lotus flower, barley corn, elephant goad, thunderbolt, and flag. My dear king, seeing his footprints on the path among the cow's hoofprints, the residents of Vrindavan rushed along in great haste. The BB2 purport states, Srila Sanatana Goswami comments as follows. Since Lord Krishna had passed along the path some time previously, why weren't his footprints, which were surrounded by those of cows, cowherd boys, and so on, smudged over and brushed away? Why hadn't his footprints been obliterated by those of the beasts and birds of Vrindavan forest? The answer is indicated by the word Vishpati, master of the cowherd community. Since Lord Krishna is actually the wealth of all living beings, all the inhabitants of the forest of Vrindavan would carefully preserve his footprints as great treasures, the very ornaments of the earth. Thus no creature within Vrindavan would ever walk upon Lord Krishna's footprints. Right? So as he walks, then anybody behind him, they'll never walk on his footprints. Like that, because Krishna being so important to them, then that affection they have, then they're always careful. Because otherwise, anything goes along, when cows go along, there's nothing left of it, you know. It's just, that's the way it works. But they're very, very careful. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, as they hurried along the path to the bank of the Jamuna River, they saw from a distance that Krishna was in the lake, motionless within the coils of the black serpent. They further saw that the cowherd boys had fallen unconscious and that the animals were standing on all sides, crying out for Krishna. Seeing all this, the residents of Vrindavan were overwhelmed with anguish and confusion. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur elaborates. Right? So Balaram smiled before, so then that anxiety that came up in the first, that maybe Krishna died and all, because they saw all the inauspicious omens. So then they gave up that lamentation. Now, but they want to see Krishna, so then they go. Now, then seeing him there, then they come up with this. Then the lamentation starts. Sri Sukadeva Goswami... Oh, no, where will we... Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur elaborates, this verse depicts the distress of the gopas and gopis. Seeing Krishna motionless in the coils of the serpent in the lake, they asked the boys, tell us what happened. Did Kaliya snatch Krishna from the bank and pull him in the water? Or did Krishna jump from the bank into the water? Was this his own idea or someone else's order? Seeing the boys wanting to answer but not being able to because of their minds had stopped functioning, Nanda and the other cowherd men and women became even more stunned than the boys. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, when the young gopis, whose minds were constantly attached to Krishna, the unlimited Supreme Lord, saw that he was now within the grips of the serpent, they remembered his loving friendship, his smiling glances, and his talks with them. Burning with great sorrow, they saw the entire universe as void. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book. Right, so here's an aspect where you have a few times that you have that, you know, the most famous is known as Prema Sarovar, where you can be with Krishna and one's in separation. So that's something very specific to the young gopis. Right? They can taste both at once. They're with Krishna, but they're feeling separation. When they're in separation, remembering Krishna, they're with Krishna. So that's the thing, is we get too much into, oh, this is that, and, you know, try to categorize things in nice little corporate boxes and stuff like that. But it's not actually like that. You remember Krishna, you're with him. Right? But at the same time, it doesn't give the flavor of being with him, therefore it's called separation. Mm-hmm. But that remembrance of him, then it's like you're with him. So you're getting both, the taste of being with him and separated at the same time. So it's different. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense? Okay. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna book, although the residents of Vrindavan did not know much about Krishna, their love for him was beyond comparison. Because right? They weren't, you know, the great scholars and new, like Uddhava. Now he would know a lot about Krishna. But as soon as they saw that Krishna was in the river Jamuna, enveloped by the serpent Kaliya, and all the boys and cows were lamenting, they simply began to think of Krishna's friendship, his smiling face, his sweet words, and his dealings with them. Thinking of all these things and seeing that the Krishna is now within the clutches of Kaliya, they at once felt that the three worlds had become vacant. Lord Chaitanya also said that he was seeing the three worlds as vacant for want of Krishna. This is the highest stage of Krishna consciousness. So if what's being explained here doesn't make sense, don't worry, because it's the highest stage. So you need to chant a few more rounds, and then it'll start to make some more sense. Yes?
Here we see that they're coward men, ladies and all of them. They're very simple, that their main quality in those relationships. And we see that this is the highest goal we all aspire to achieve, to be the residents there. But here, everybody has their own condition nature, which might not be as simple, and usually not simple.
Okay.
But it's not going to change anyway.
It can be purified.
Purified, but it's not going to become simple.
It can stop being complicated and be sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So you can get rid of the complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So in other words, for the devotional Facebook, you know, when it says relationship, you wouldn't say it's complicated. Like that, you know. Amongst the karmis, yes, but the devotees, no. So that would see they're simple. Is that means? They don't require a vast amount of knowledge to appreciate Krishna's greatness. The greater knowledge, the greater they understand. Like Uddhava in the Dwarka is the greatest devotee. He knows the most about Krishna. And so he can appreciate the widest range, and he's therefore the greatest. But in Braj, it's not that they require the knowledge to love Krishna. Right? So that's why it says they don't have that much. They don't have, because it's not required for the relationship. All the residents did not know much about Krishna. But the point is at the same time, is because they're so absorbed in Krishna, they can explain from their relationship with Krishna. And in this way, they may have way more knowledge as such than the others. because their experience of Krishna is so deep that therefore they can explain things that others can't explain, so you'll take them as more intellectual. You know, as we see, like with Jiva Goswami. Then the point being that when it says that he's, you know, in the contemporary environment, we're talking about the Vedic concept of contemporary, not our concept. So that means, you know, from now to the, basically for the whole Kali Yuga, there is no scholar like him. He's the most scholarly scholar of any of the scholars. But they're just explaining the fine points of the rasa that they teach. But when you explain it, then it comes out as tattva. You know what I'm saying? Because they're explaining it so you understand it, rather than explaining it to taste it. But those who know how to taste, they taste from that. You know, and for us, then we get, you know, because if it wasn't explained in that way, then we wouldn't. You understand? So the situational aspects of it can be explained. The taste itself, that can never be explained. You can't write that down. You know, that's why they'll say they just were merged in an ocean of bliss. It doesn't say any more than that. You can't explain it. But they can say this one was here, that one was here, this one was doing this, that was doing that, this subtlety was there, that more subtlety was there. That they can explain. You know what I'm saying? So they'll explain the science of what's happening. Right? Then we get that benefit. You know, up to the point where, as it is, this point already is stretching the limits of our ability to understand. Right? And so this is how much they documented. Whatever they wrote in literature is beyond this. Those are the ones that they dug a hole and put them inside and made a samadhi. Right? Because as it is, we're already freaking out. But it's a negative emotion. Or how could Krishna be off with someone else's wife? Or, you know, all these different things. Or how can he manifest, you know, killing the demons and all this, but then not change their mood towards him and create a whole Vaikuntha thing? And so this is our limit. And so that's why that's all the more that's been explained. Does that make sense?
Can we say that in order to develop simplicity, we need to understand what is the primary and the secondary?
The secondary, yes. Simplicity comes by understanding what's primary and secondary. Here, when simple, it doesn't mean simpleton. We're not meaning that they're like idiots or something, the village idiot. We're meaning that it's not complicated. It's just they love Krishna. That's all. It's not complicated. That's all.
Yes.
So therefore, it's simple. But in the modern concept, we think simple means no brains, no anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the difficulty. So we take it that complicated is good. But in the Vedic, you have simple but sophisticated. You don't get anything more sophisticated than the service that's rendered by the residents of Vrindavan to Krishna. Mm-hmm. It's the most refined. It's even greater than Vaikuntha. Now, they'll sing great music in Vaikuntha. But what the gopis will sing will even be beyond that. What Krishna plays on his flute, Brahma and Shiva, though they are expert in music, they can't understand. Like the modern classical music in India, they'll attribute it back to Lord Shiva. But they don't get it. Shiva gets it from Krishna. Right? So he can't understand it. Like that. But the gopis, they're inspired. They understand. It doesn't say they become bewildered in another way out of affection for Krishna. They just become intellectually bewildered because they know music and they don't know how to do that, where that comes from. They have no understanding. So we see is that when Radharani, when Krishna came dressed as a girl from the heavenly planets, one of the things that they ask her to do is play some music that's appropriate for her position, which is play a particular raga, which is very subtle, in Gagrama. Because you have the notes off of Sadegama Padanisa, that's called Sagrama. Yes. Right? And then you have the Samaveda, which is off Ma. So where Ma is on the scale, it's actually become Sa. So that means it shifts the proportion of the notes. Like that. But Gagrama means you start off of Ga, off the third note. Right? So we take the first as the first. Mm-hmm. Then the next difficult is taking the fifth as the first. Then the most difficult is taking the third as the first. So the proportions are different, and that means then all the half the semitones in between the notes, they also are shifting. Does that make sense? Because in there, sa has four notes, you know, sometimes. So you have 4-3-2, 4-4-3-2. That's how it'll work in sa. But when you adjust it over to the other ones, that means that proportion goes off. So you have to be able to know how to shift those. You know, so, what is it? 4-3-2. So there's only two in ga. That means sa only has two positions. But that means that when you go up, then da now has four positions. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the thing, is to be able to understand that and where those would move. So it's very so. Therefore, then Radharani asked her to sing that. And so then, you know, so that means they know the most sophisticated music. That means music that we have that Brahma and Shiva knows comes from Vaikuntha, which comes from what the gopis sing. So that's the highest. So they're the most sophisticated, but at the same time they're the most simple. That doesn't make sense in the modern context. Because it's simple means, you know, unsophisticated, you know, even gross or uncultured. And complicated means sophisticated. So we don't have such a thing as simple and sophisticated. That's then something that we're not used to. Does that make sense? So that's why it becomes hard to appreciate that aspect, because then we wonder, well, how is it that when they come, they know the philosophy so well? Because they realize Krishna from sweetness. So if they explain that, that's the source. That's Tattva is only explaining Krishna and his relationship with the devotees. That's all it's explaining. Right? So Krishna and his energies. Right? So that's what Tattva explains. Who is Krishna? Who are his energies? What's their relationship? How do they act in that relationship? What's the result of that relationship? Right? So then we're used to it for more from the intellectual side, from the more Vaikuntha kind of aspect. But the other one comes from the rasa aspect, but at the same time is because you're explaining it logically, then it will be therefore the most logical. So that's why the tattva sandarbhas the sandarbhas themselves are the most, you know, subtle or most technical of all the works of the acharyas. So to break things down, it's like all the anuchetas that are in the Vedanta Sutra won't be as many as there are in the Satsandarbhas. They have many more. That means all those anuchetas that are in the Vedanta are all there, but then he has given subsections of those. Does that make sense? So you're dealing with some really serious, you know, intellectual. And so this can be understood by devotion. Scholars can sit around and appreciate the technicality that's there, but they can't actually understand what's going on. Does that make sense? Okay, so this whole point is that and so they're there with Krishna, but feeling it's empty, because if they can't interact with Krishna, what's the point of the whole cosmos? Right, so that's the whole point, is because how do they render service to Krishna? So in a situation where you can't render service to Krishna, what's the point of the situation? So it's empty. Mm-hmm. That's there. That's just part of the conjugal bhav. That's all. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, although the elder gopis were feeling just as much distress as she, and were pouring forth a flood of sorrowful tears, they had to forcibly hold back Krishna's mother, whose consciousness was totally absorbed in her son, standing like corpses with their eyes fixed upon his face. These gopis each took turns recounting the pastimes of the darling of Braja. So from this we can conclude there's a lot of people not in Bhagavatam class. Okay, the tractor I understand. Standing like corpses with their eyes fixed upon his face, these gopis each took turns recounting the pastimes of the darling of Braja. And so then by discussing these things, it would make her feel better and make themselves. Srila Sanatana Goswami comments, but alas, how did she, his mother, react? In reply to this, it is described in this verse, the special condition of all of them, revealing only a little because of Sukadev's own burden of sorrow. Right, because he can't say too much. Yes. Otherwise, the whole thing will stop, and then we won't get very far in 7 days. Right? The apatya is him because of whom a family does not fall into distress, or in other words, the son who is the object of greatest affection. Therefore, casting her glance at him, she was most excessively tormented on account of him. Right? So the apatya is him who a family does not fall into distress. Right? So that member of the family who always keeps their family in good spirits. Right? Inspired and everything. So they're the apatya. So Krishna is the apatya. So he's the apatya for everyone. Right? So for Mother Yashoda, she's the son. For the boys, then he's the friend. For the gopis, then he's the, you know, the lover, like this. So therefore, casting her glance, so of all of them, then they'll all see Krishna as her son, but Krishna is her son, so it's even more intense in her. Right? Therefore, casting her glance at him, she was most excessively tormented on account of him, even though equally pained as her. Is there a sign out there, you know, that the thing like that says honk? This always going to come right here. They always honk here. You know, so. Yeah. Yeah, what's it? Honk if you love Krishna. Yes. Yes.
So we see here that the residents of Vrindavan, they experience Anubhava and Sattvika Bhava simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah, no, they all go on at once. We explain them individually so that we understand, just like when we explain in the Gita, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, as separate things. But actually they function together as one thing, as buddhi yoga. It just is a matter of where it is at the particular moment. You're using more karma, using more jnana, using more meditation on Krishna. So it's separated, just like a car. You explain each thing. You know, you explain the steering wheel, you explain the pedals, but they're all used together. So all these things happen at once. Because of their sthayi bhav, they have a particular affection. Then there's going to be aspect, so therefore then they have their relationship, the alambana, with Krishna. You know, particularly what that will be. So therefore, then one's the parent, he's the son, or one's the friend, or one's the older friend, younger friend, all these kind of things, then the alambana, right? Of who's the ashrayan vishay, and therefore how he's pleased. Then you'll have the udipan, then which will express what things that Krishna does, either physically, as far as qualities go, or these other actions, and that which then create, right? You know, in other words, on body, mind, and words, that create the impetus for that love to be expressed. So the vibhav being there, that there's an udipan, then the reaction to that, which will also be, you know, a mental and physical and all these, what they want to do, just like Mother Yashoda sees Krishna. So just seeing Krishna and his cuteness or like that, his childness, then the udipan is, I mean, the anubhav is she wants to pick him up, cuddle him, squeeze him, smell his head, you know, do all those kind of things. You understand? So it's the reaction. So in that, you get the crying, this and that. That's why it seems confusing with the other bhavas, especially Sattvika, because there's, you know, crying and this and that there. But this is the reaction that's there, the emotional reaction, and therefore what they do with that emotional reaction. Well, the Sattvika Bhava is actually the life heirs, the reaction of them from that emotion, what then they do to the body. So it may be that the so in that way, that's why technically you can count the Sattvika and the Sanchari all as Anubhavas. So sometimes the Acharyas, then they're referred to as the Anubhavas. They mean all three of them. And then sometimes they'll explain them individually, or, you know, they'll talk about the Sanchari because it's coming from that aspect, because the Sanchari is in support of the sty. It matches with the rasa there. And that's why they're limited which ones come up. So depending on the flavor of the mood, which is being affected by those, they come up. But it's coming up from there, while the Anubhava is coming up from the Vibhava. Right? And so that will have an effect, and that changes the whole flavor, but then that will... Yes?
So can we say that Anubhava comes from a conscious effort, and then...
Not necessarily. It's just that means they're conscious of Krishna, and in the way that Krishna's acting, and in the way according to their rasa, what that invokes at the point, that reaction, that response, that flavor they taste, that's the Anubhava. So maybe they just, you know, like Balaram, he just smiles. But we see the Anubhava and the others, they're getting stunned and this and that. Right? Like that. So or they're trying to enter the water, or they're trying to do different things. These are all Anubhavas. So the action they do is then the Anubhava. You know, Krishna says some clever comment that's, what would be the appropriate word? With attitude. And then the gopis react with, you know, they turn around, or they, you know, they don't talk to him, or they become, Lalita steps forward and becomes angry. These are all Anubhavas. So in other words, the Anubhavas, what they do in response to the Udipan from Krishna. So it's constantly going on. It's not that just one happens and the other happens. We're not talking about, you know, some new age music here, where the guy goes hits the, you know, the gong, boom, just leaves it there forever until you fall asleep, and then, you know, we're not talking about that kind of stuff. We're talking about that these are constantly going on, and each one's nourishing the other. And because of that, you see, because they're doing that, then, you know, Balaram himself is then, you know, seeing this and seeing their reaction. So therefore, then he's dealing and giving a smile, which is then an Udipan for them, but in a way that matches the previous reactions of their Anubhavas and Sattvika Bhavas that are going on. Does that make sense? So it's a dynamic. So we study it separately just so that we understand the elements, but it's being applied, it's all together. It's all happening at once. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that, yeah.
We see here in the purified stage, all the Brajvasis are experiencing so many different kind of emotions and enhancing the pastime.
Right.
But in the Sadhaka stage, or when we are not perfect, are there any positive or negative emotions which are acceptable in the life of
acceptable? For the brahmacharis, seeing a large amount of well-cooked halava that's already been offered to the Lord, and then they become happy, that's a, you know, it's a standard good emotion. Yeah. You know, seeing everybody else move forward to get the halava, and then you become, you know, how you say, an anxiety or things like that. That's another, you know. Does that make sense? And when the crowd clears and you finally get to the front and there is no bucket of halava, then that devastation. There's all kinds of voice becoming choked up. Yeah. So it's in the context of the individual. Yeah. Means the point is emotion, we're happy in Krishna consciousness, and, you know, and we're sad at others not being able to be engaged in Krishna consciousness. So, yeah. But does that make sense? Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Can we say that Anubhav, it is a result of Vibhav?
It's a result of Vibhav.
Yeah, basically, it is simply an extension of Vibhav where the interaction goes on with Krishna.
It's an extension of Vibhav. No, it's its own. Its own. It's in its own position.
Okay. But.
But then, because Vibhav is an extension of the Stai Bhav, so then we could just say the Stai Bhav and not get into the details.
So Anubhav is being physical in Krishna, but whereas
Anubhav is being physical, it may be emotional, it may be, it has all those levels. That's why you see, if you read the Anubhavas, one, we get the ideas that you have these emotional and physical things that you also have in the Sattvika Bhavas. The one is it's coming though from the emotions being felt, the other is coming from the effect of the life airs. So that's the difference between sattvika, because otherwise some of the things in sattvika and some of the things in anubhava are the same, and some of the things in the sanchari bhavas are the same. So that's why it's an extension. It's just the one causes the other, but the point is they're all, it's just the love for Krishna. You know what I'm saying? So you can have something that's the major thing being tasted, and then there's the minor thing that's being tasted in the sanchari. So in other words, Anubhav will be there longer. The Sanchari Bhav is just transitory. It's just coming up and going. That's why it says, sometimes it says acute.
Yeah.
And so in it coming up, it may even upstage the main one because it comes in so strongly. Right? Or it just may come up and it's kind of there existing. So they're called sometimes called existential.
Yeah.
Or sometimes called acute. So it just depends upon what effect they're having.
Okay.
You know, so I'm saying, you're dealing with something very sophisticated here, right? So it won't fit in our corporate boxes. That's the problem. You know what I'm saying? So it's just these. Yeah.
Thank you, Maharaj.
What's Vibhava then?
Vibhava means is the you could say is the basic. It has two aspects: alambana, which means the ashray and the vishay. Right, just like Krishna is always the Vishay, the devotee is the Ashray, but in what context? You know, so he's the Vishay as the son, and Mother Yashoda is the Ashray as the senior. But then, let's say in servitorship, then Krishna is the senior, though he's the Vishay, and the devotee is the junior. Right, so it just establishes that it's all about Krishna. But then in that means that Krishna, in interacting with the devotees, it'll be based on the devotee's ashray. See, that's the point. He is rasa. Right? Mother Yashoda is in a rasa. Krishna's not in a rasa. He is rasa. So therefore, because Mother Yashoda, he is the vishay. And because Mother Yashoda is the ashray, deals with Krishna in a particular way, Krishna then reciprocates that way, how she deals as the ashray. So even though it's about Krishna as the vishay, the actual interaction, it's about the ashray. Right? So this is the difficulty that comes up in the relation, in the, how you say, our understanding of relationships. We think that if something's going one way, everything's one way. Right? You know, it's, in other words, the someone may be the how you say, Krishna is the object of everybody's love, but in the interaction, he's not the object; he's the subject, and the devotee is the object. So that's where it becomes difficult. You know, like that. So, because we're thinking, no, it's about us, so therefore, just like your common, probably you could say your most common misunderstanding of this principle is the men and their wives. So the man thinks, I'm the authority, you know, like that, and the wife follows the husband, and I think that's it, right? Yeah, exactly. The whole false ego is based on these two things. So then they take it's all about them. But what they misunderstand is that the focus is therefore on the ashray, so therefore it's on the wife. So it's all about what makes the wife happy. You know. So, but that doesn't fly in the misogynistic world. Right? Like that. Because them, is there. So where is the mistake being made? Because they're looking at themselves as the center of attention from a woman. And what in what relationship with a woman are they the ashram? The son. So that means they expect their wife to deal with them like their mother would. In fact, it's all about them. They don't even have to do anything. In fact, they'll always, no matter what happens, they'll always show their base face. They can be grumpy, they can be nasty, they can be snarky, but their mom will always, you know, tolerate. Yeah, like that. And they expect that from the wife. So that's the difficulty. So they think it's all about them. So here, it's the mother's in charge, but it's all about them. Now I become a husband, I'm in charge, and it's all about me. You know, so it doesn't get better than that, right? Right? But what's not understood is what they're actually doing in real-time relationships is a relationship between two women, where one woman is the senior woman. So she's the senior woman, and it's about her. So that only works in the feminine world. And then the fun part is the guys who are the most attached to this and push this the most, then they claim to be the most manly. But actually, they're the most, you know, female. Right? Does that make sense? Because if you have a woman there and a man there, it can work. Right? Two men works fine. A man and a woman can work fine. Not necessarily, but can. Two women, problem. So if there's always a problem, what does that mean? There's two women in the room. Just one looks a little better than the other. So then it's obvious which one should be the senior of the two women. Right? Yeah. You understand? So we're not used to this. But in here, as the acharyas point out, those who can taste rasa, they can understand these things. And then they see how these things work. So,
what's the one? Vibhava, Alandan, and what's the second one?
The other is Udipan. So Udipan means the specifics of what Krishna on the body, mind, and words attracts them. You know, so his beauty, how he plays the flute, his moods, you know, all these, his glances, all these different things. There. And it can be anything even connected with Krishna, depending upon the rasa. You know, so like for the cowherd boys going out into the forest, that will remind them of Krishna, so that's an Udipan to remember Krishna. Does that make sense? Or Mother Jashoda will come into Krishna's room, even though Krishna's out during the day, so she'll remember Krishna. Like that. Does that make sense?
In Anubhavas, they divide into Sattvika and Sanchari?
No, no. Anu means you can. Anubhavas are their own category. Then Sattvika Bhavas are their own category. The Sanchari Bhavas are their own category. But because they're all in response to the Vibhava, you know, either directly or indirectly, right? Then, in one sense, to just say things in general, you can say Anubhava. Even though it may be a Sanchari Bhava or a Sattvika Bhava, you just say Anubhava. But if you're being specific, the Anubhavas are specific things, Sattvika is specific, and Sanchari, because that's how you define which ones work for which rasa. Because each rasa has its own mood, has its own Alambana and Udipans, it has its own Anubhavas, own Sattvika Bhavas, and own Sanchari Bhavas. It means there's you know, it means in that you have, I think it's 8 Sattvika Bhavas. I'm not sure how many it is in the Anubhavas. 13.
And
the,
13
in Anubhavas. And then in the Sanchari Bhavas, there's 33. But depending upon the rasas, they may have some of the, you know, a certain amount of those or not. Because certain ones don't match certain rasas. Is that something sense? And also the same with secondary rasas. The secondary rasas, depending upon the primary rasa, it may have certain secondary rasas. So all that's there.
You know that when you said that when the interaction begins, you know, between Krishna and the devotees, Krishna becomes the subject and the devotees become the object. So this is what gives rise to the rasa.
Yes. It means the Vibhava gives rise to it actually being happening. It means they have it there, that's inherent. Mm-hmm. But it's the Vibhava that manifests it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the point is this, because I said that is because there comes a confusion comes up. Because generally all the time we say that Krishna should be the object of one's affection, you know, one's everything one does,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But in another place, then Rupa Goswami says Krishna is the supreme subject and Radharani is the supreme object. So then one might get confused in this, right? But the whole point is, it means everything's directed towards Krishna. But the point is when Krishna is involved in interacting, he then interacts with the devotee. So he's the subject. Meaning he's the subject, like you take from the grammatical aspect. He's the one that's making the action. He's in the masculine position. And the devotee is therefore in the feminine position based off of their mood is how Krishna reacts with them. Like that? And then the action itself is the verb. But of all the devotees that are object for Krishna, then Radharani is the supreme. Right, and of all the subjects who are performing activities, then Krishna, in connection with Radharani, is the supreme subject. But at the same time, as you can say, yes, Krishna is the object, you know, but at the same time, is his object is the devotees. So it doesn't even, the two don't even contradict each other. It's just you have to be able to see them in which context they're being used, but they don't contradict each other. Because even though Krishna is the supreme object, then it comes back to the devotee as the ashraya of the relationship. And so therefore he performs the activity as the... So we make him as the object, but then when he reciprocates that, he becomes the subject, we're the object. You know, because we're saying, I'm performing an activity, so I'm offering the artik. So in this way, I'm the subject, Krishna is the object who is being offered towards. But the point is then Krishna then reciprocates that. So since he's the Vishai, then he's the top of this.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. As you surrender, he reciprocates. That also applies for Prabhu's question before about the Raga, you know, the Vaidhi, and if we're, you know, worshipping Radha and Krishna, but we're worshipping as Lakshmi and Narayana, because how we surrender.
So he prepared the field, and we as human entities can interact in the field, and
yes.
We reciprocate in the
field. Yes, means the situation is him, it's created by his desire. And the devotees then, they have their desire what to do with that situation to please Krishna. So in other words, he's creating the situation, but the transformations within that field are created by the devotees. And then depending upon that, Krishna then responds to them, and then their response to them, him. So we just start that there's this thing here, but it's not that that there's nothing and then there starts something. It's always going on. We just, for understanding's sake, we break it down like that. Does that make sense? Like Krishna, then he's created the situation, you know, through Yoga Maya, that there is the, you know, the Sarat Purnima, and there's just the beauty of the moon and everything, and the weather, and everything's just perfect for a rasa dance. So then he then does something as the subject, directed towards the gopis as the object. Then they then respond to that. Then there's their anubhava, so then they try to get dressed and come meet Krishna, and, you know, so it's all going, it's all arranged by Yoga Maya. So Krishna doesn't have to be specifically aware of it. He doesn't have to take care of the mechanics. We think, oh, he's doing that, how he'll take care? Because his energies take care of the mechanics. That's what Kriya and Jnana Shaktis do. His desire, they take care of it. Like if you sit there and think, wow, I'd like this to eat, then your other energies go and arrange it. Isn't that how it works? Yes. Yeah, that's the dynamic in family life, is you're trying to figure out who's the energy. You know, it's kind of like, wow, Prabhu, you know, you haven't made those great, you know, sandwiches that you make for such a long time. You know? Like that. And then if he just says, yeah, no, I haven't. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, so tomorrow then we're... Yeah, then that was okay. That was a waste. And he says, oh, really? Yeah, I could make some now. I think you... Really? Oh, that would be wonderful. Yeah? Okay. No, it's really funny. Everyone else is like, you know, different, yeah, oh yeah, right, and this and that, and all that, and then over this side it's just all dead. Not sure what Maharaj is talking about, but yeah. Yes.
When we see the language of Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra,
yes,
we see that it's very complex. Complex terminology is being used and all, and that's how I mean.
Complex which?
Terminology, terms and all.
Well, that's because you're working on Vedic words, and Vedic nirukta means what's the obscure meaning, right? See, classical Sanskrit is you're using what's the poetic meaning, and according, in other words, the mood and the flavor that's there, then you'll use appropriate words. But the Vedic Sanskrit, it's always about obscure words. Because you're talking about... Because in the Vedas, since everything's coming from there, that means all the various aspects are there. So you have to use a word that can mean all those different things. Right? And because you're dealing with... It's kind of like intellectual poetry. Classical Sanskrit is mental poetry. You know, or emotional poetry. This is intellectual poetry. So therefore, then, the more obscure it is, the more intellectually interesting it is. But the point is once you're adjusted with the words, what's the problem? That's what Vedanta Sutra does. It defines what are these words, how they're actually used. Then, looking at the Upanishads, it's very straightforward. Does that make sense? So it's only because we're used to one and we're not used to the other. We're used to the mind going from desire to purpose, then back to knowledge, right? Then activity. So that's how the mind works. The intelligence works, the relationship, the process, the result. So that's how Vedanta Sutra and the Upanishads work. So it's just a matter of getting adjusted to the difference of that. Otherwise, then... It's not complicated. It's quite simple. But it's very sophisticated. That's what we mean. So from the Western point of view or the modern point of view, we'll think it's complicated, but it's not. It's actually very simple. Is that?
Yeah, this one. I appreciate it.
So that's why then you have to be checking what the Nirukta says. You know what I'm saying? In other words, how you say, your German friend... His dictionary is not going to work for you. You have to use Nirukta.
So Maharaj, then my question was this, that when we explain philosophy, when we are explaining this tattva and all, so is complexity considered a virtue, or is it that...
It depends on the audience.
Okay.
It's just according to the audience, how sophisticated or detailed you can get. So it's simply, if people don't know, then you deal in that simpler way. They know more, then you deal in that way. So it's just according to the audience. It's the same thing. You're, as a teacher or preacher, speaking according to the audience, right? Because if you're in the position of the subject, then you have to direct what you're speaking about Krishna to according to the object. That's preaching. That's teaching. So this modern concept of... Why I say modern, and I specifically mean modern, of hard preaching, soft preaching, because that's not Vedic, it's not Gaudiya, it's a modern concept. Right? It's because of misunderstanding what preaching means. Preaching means you speak according to the audience. So therefore, let's say your audience is straight edge. The heavier it is, the happier they become. Right? But if you're speaking to emos, the softer it is, the better it works. You understand? So you're talking to intellectuals, it's one way. You're talking to, you know, the guy has a muscle truck with two shotguns in the back window, you talk a little bit differently. You know, it's just, you know, you adjust according to who you are. That's preaching. That's actually understanding how relationship works. Now, if you don't understand relationships, so that you're more worried about the content of what you're saying, but not about the person, that's called hard preaching. But at least then you're talking Krishna consciousness. Then soft preaching, then you're worried about the person, not about the philosophy, so it may or may not actually be Krishna conscious. I've seen soft preaching, it's got nothing to do with Krishna at all. In fact, when they come into the yoga studio and do the kirtan, they're doing a Shiva or a Ganesh kirtan, because if we do Hare Krishna, they'll know we're Hare Krishna, and then we're forcing that upon them. Well, what about forcing a Ganesh bhajan on them? It's like they came there to learn about Ganesh, So it's just what I'm saying. It's mundane. It's not. The point is you speak according to the audience, and you get the effect, and that's according to you. So how you can get the effect of people having faith in Krishna consciousness, that's what you do. But don't say, well, this is soft preaching, this is a real preaching. No, that's what that's what you can do in that situation, while someone else in that situation does something different. Like Prabhupada in Sweden, right, in Stockholm at their main university, and the Swedes are known for their equality base. They don't like breaking down anybody into any kind of demographic. And Prabhupada gave a strong lecture on Varnashram about first class, and he didn't just say, intellectuals and that would have been, would have gone over easily. He specifically said first class man, second class man, third class man, and fourth class man, just to be in their face. Because they think they're so special because they see everyone equal. And so then afterwards, then someone asked, so what class man are you? And they expect him to say first class, like that. He said, I'm fifth class, servant of the other four. Diffused the whole thing. Now they're ready to listen. So then he could speak, and from that, one person became a devotee. You understand? So Prabhupada could do that there. We may not do that there. We would probably just use about, society have intellectual, that we wouldn't do that. But Prabhupada could. But he got the effect, so it's not hard preaching, it's preaching. So if you have to deal in and deal at all, very soft language or very indirect, but you get the point where they get faith and surrender to Krishna, then that's the preaching. Don't call it soft and hard. You know what I'm saying? Call it preaching. Because soft and hard are wrong. Preaching is what you want to do. Does that make sense? Yeah, so the whole point, just like, let's say I'm cooking something, okay? Let's say I am, frying something in a pan, okay? That needs to be turned over. So if I go in there and very roughly turn it over so it ends up in three or four pieces, would I call that cooking? So why call it hard cooking? It's not cooking. You understand? Because it's not cooking. So now, if I go in there and I don't deal with it and it's sticking a little bit, so I don't want to do anything and I don't want to, disturb it and all that, because it seems to like being that way. So then do I call that soft cooking? No, that's also not cooking. So there is no such thing as hard preaching and soft preaching. There's preaching. In other words, if you're getting effect, it's preaching. If you're not, then it was too hard or too soft. But don't add the word preaching into it. Because you say, oh, but before people preached hard, yeah, and they made tons of devotees also. So it wasn't hard preaching. It was what people wanted to hear. They wanted people with confidence that understood what they were doing, committed to it. While soft preaching, then where's the commitment? Why should I surrender my life to somebody who's, just like a marshmallow or something? You understand? Yeah, you want somebody strong. And you see, and today in the modern world, people who are strong, outspoken, and that's who people follow. They don't follow the mamby-pamby ones. They don't. And then we're saying soft preaching is, no, it's not. So in other words, people who identify them as soft preaching, they are dealing with an audience that how they deal, it works. That's why they make them devotees. But it's not soft preaching. Because if they tried that preaching in another scenario, it would not work. So it's not soft, it's preaching. Does that make sense? So we have to know what preaching is. Does that make sense? So therefore, then, in these things, the intellectual aspect is used if people are more intellectual. Just like if you're South India giving a lecture, make it as intellectual as you like, as logical, and they'll all be more happy. Well, in North, you better tell a story and throw a bhajan in when they fall asleep, because you know, too many rotis and they can't pay attention. You know? Does that make sense? That's amazing. In North, you eat rice, it puts you to sleep. But in South, you eat rice, it doesn't put them to sleep. Because right? They eat more. It means they, people say Bengalis eat a lot of rice. They don't eat anywhere near what a South Indian eats. You know? But they don't fall asleep. You never see a South Indian falling asleep after eating. Okay. So, yes? Okay. 1 minute.
Past 2 days, what we are speaking about, the professionalism which is integrated in ISKCON.
Yeah, professional mentality. We don't mind someone's professional. It's just the professional mentality.
So, is it that somewhere knowingly, unknowingly, the Yukta Vairagya principle is being misused?
Yes, it's Yukta Vairagya, because we're taking, the thing is if we look at it, Yukta Vairagya is made of two words. Yukta, which means connected to Krishna, right? Which means it's actually to please Krishna. When we have attitude, a professional attitude, the attitude doesn't please Krishna, so it's not yukta. And vairagya means it's without attachment. It's for pleasing Krishna. So therefore, us taking that attitude is because it's good for us. I feel superior because I have the professional attitude. So as far as attitude goes, there's no yukta and no vairagya. But the service that's performed with that knowledge and skill, that may be connected to Krishna. So on that side, then you can say it's devotional. But the problem is because of the two, the attitude and the knowledge and skill, the attitude is actually more important, then it's a mistake. So it's a neophyte mistake. But because we're professional, we consider we're more advanced. When actually, due to the mode of ignorance, we're seeing things opposite of what they actually are. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's only because the idea that the modern world has something to offer, the Western world is so advanced and all that, the Vedic civilization is not very advanced. It's due to this lack of faith in that the Vedic culture is actually more. Just like the same thing stems, everything's not in Prabhupada's books when everything is. Mm-hmm. Detail may not be, but you don't have to have detail. You know, it's just like this. It's just like, what do you call it? Yeah. So, the detail can be found somewhere else. All the detail is given in all the other literature, so Bhagavatam doesn't have to explain the detail. It simply gives the principle and how that principle connects to Krishna. So that means it's dealing with everything. So if you understand that, you actually understand Vedic knowledge. And if you think, no, things are missing from Prabhupada's books, and that means you actually don't understand. You're actually uneducated. But unfortunately, the people who are in that situation, because of their academic ego, they can't tolerate that you deal like that and speak like that. That's the problem. So the false ego doesn't allow. So the idea is that the West is doing so many things and we should follow the West and all that, and they're successful, but are they? You take it in general, yes, there's somebody who's successful. But watch how long that guy is on the top of the stocks, and after how many days or minutes he's down on the bottom again. So we just take the overall that they have money. But if you take the overall, if we look in history, where was all the money in the world?
India.
It was in India. That's why everybody came here. Right? Nobody comes here because they like the view or something, you know? Like that. What was it? Somnath in Gujarat was sacked, I think, 17 times. That means they took every last bit they could. Right? They're not going to leave anything. Right? And then it was replaced. Anywhere else in the world, you have this fabulous temple and all that, all the gold and jewels and all that. Then some marauders come in, generally the same ones that came to India. And then they take everything, and then that's it. It's in ruins, and now we go and look at the ruins. They've just replaced it. Right? So, who's not successful? Right? How many Americans in the American scene are successful in proportion? Right? Not a great percentage. What's the proportion of Indians that go over there that are successful? Probably most of them. They'll go in, start off as driving a taxi, and then after a while you see they own a house, they're not on a mortgage, and they got cars and this and that, and then after, you know, it just goes from there. So in reality, then the Vedic culture is so much superior. They can have a professional thing and have a family relationship, while the Westerners, the two will never meet. You can't have both. Because they don't know how to deal with these things. They're one or the other. You understand? But there's this illusion that the West is so successful and so fabulous and so this and this and that. Just people don't look around. Fifth Avenue looks okay. Walk over another block and that, and you're in slums, literally. Most of New York is just slums. It may be cleaner, but it's a slum. You look at any big city there, it's a slum. Unless it's a new development, but the old development, it's a slum. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing. We think that there's something, they're so fabulous. It's just that they got more attitude than everyone. Right? The Europeans come to India, and why could they feel so confident to exploit everything and take everything? Because the locals are savages. Right? But the point is Ayurveda is so much more developed. You know, the law system, the economics, everything. Why did they come here? Because there was money here. How much money is over there? What can you grow in England? What's the natural resource of England? Potatoes? Huh? Oatmeal?
Fish.
Really?
Huh?
I think they probably picked that up from the Japanese. Okay, but whatever. You know, that's it. So they have to come everywhere else to get money. Where's the natural resources? You understand? So the whole thing is the Indians are the savages. And then, you know, they hired Max Mueller to drive that home through their own scriptures. And then the fun part is 2017, the Indians buy it themselves. So that's the thing, is that it's like things go down, okay? Kerala, everything goes down. It's just some funny place. Then one day, some smart guy, Indian guy, right? He figures out in the West, they're into spas. And these various kinds of treatments with mud or this or that or massages and stuff like that. But in the Kerala medicine, they practice a lot of these massage and spa kind of stuff. So then they market it. And now it's huge. You want to get, you know, a 2-week thing costs you $1,000. You know what I'm saying? But it's only what the Western will like. But it's always been there. Right? The Indian fabric, the this and that, it's all, they all appreciate anything that is of the Indian culture. The tradition, it's always appreciated in the West. They just want it on their own terms. But somehow or another, we think it's inferior. You know what I'm saying?
So when we are using the Yukta Pairagya principle,
what
is the prerequisite for that? Because
the prerequisite for it is be Krishna conscious. Follow the mood that Prabhupada gives. Prabhupada wanted us to do things first class, but he didn't want this attitude that I'm a professional, so that's what's good about it. Because otherwise, then how is it going to be pleasing to Krishna? Because our professionalism, the knowledge and skill comes from Krishna anyway. So how is he pleased if it's not offered with devotion? You're offering Ganga water back to the Ganga. Now, if you offer it with attitude, I got this Ganga water out, and now I got this, and now it's special. And so because it's special, because it touched me, now I'm pouring that back into the Ganga as an offering. She's going to love that one? No. So then why will the attitude? In other words, the skill is fine, but the attitude, that needs some serious work. You know what I'm saying? And then all this thing is only they have the knowledge, India has the knowledge. Otherwise, why do Indians go to the West and do well? All those Indians in America making money, they're not reading any of those success books. You understand? And now we're reading the success books, and now we're going to be? The Americans read them because they are not successful. And now by you reading them, you'll be successful? It's like, give me a break. It doesn't make any sense. You can say, oh, but there's so many things we can learn. It says, yeah, you can learn if you know that subject. A businessman reading a book on business could catch a few nice points. But if you're not a businessman, you could read the book all day and never learn anything. So therefore, it's not the book that makes you successful. It's that you have the potential for success that makes you successful. Does that make sense? Like, if I have someone who can't carry a tune in a bucket, and I give them a music lesson, now do they become a virtuoso? No, but someone who has the potential as a virtuoso, and you show them that they can do something with it. That's why this idea we're going to just take anybody who's interested and make them into professionals is one of the biggest practical foolishnesses that one could ever make the mistake of doing. Because in the karmi world, no, you have to be already show that you're a professional, then we'll talk about making you a professional. Does that make sense? Let's see. Oops. Gotta go. Oh. Hare Krishna.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama.